I have a reminder to myself that says, have you experienced the sacred recently? And the reason I have that reminder is to be like, yo, it's not just about building a piece of software and making it to help people. It's also about kind of the purity of isolation and like doing something that you want for its own sake and all these other things. So it's almost like I have two different versions of myself that they're not in conflict with one another, but I need to satisfy both of them in order to do well for myself and to be happy, I think.
Caw, caw. That's the crow of wisdom that is gracing us with her presence today in this episode with Julian Smith. Julian is a New York Times bestselling author. He's one of the first podcasters. He originally wanted to be a sculptor. He is the founder of a unicorn, massively successful company, hundreds of employees, called Breather, raised $150 million, and now is the founder. He's back in the trenches at the very genesis of his next venture called Practice, helping coaches run their businesses. He is a consummate creator. Just in those things that I've listed, it requires a pretty unique creator's mind, but it's also something that he talks about on the episode of writing 1,000 words every morning, just taking inventory on what's going through his mind. So just a very reflective individual to get to chat with in the midst of building, as well as on the other side of building quite a few successful things. So I love this conversation. I think you all as listeners are going to love this conversation. So without further ado, let's get into it with Julian Smith. This is Below the Line. And we are live. Yes, what is that in your
Okay,
hand?
wow. What a way to begin. So this is an Ember mug. This podcast is sponsored by Magic Mind and Ember Mug accidentally. So you see, it's got a little thing here. It's like, and so if you want your coffee, as I do, because I walk away from it is the issue. And then I'll come back and I'll be like, that I had it at that temperature. I kind of wanted it at, and it would be cold otherwise. So here it'll keep it. You want it at 195? Bam, you choose it via an app, of course,
Of
right?
course, of
And then
course.
at 195, it'll stay there. Next day, you decide, oh, that's too hot for me. I want it in 192 typically. It'll leave it there at 192. It's nuts. It's out of this world, isn't
I've heard of those things. I didn't know it could get that hot. I thought it would just keep it warm, but not like keep it precisely at a
it? So
specific
yeah, there are
temperature.
some, the sort of generic ones that'll just warm it up. But this one is the, and they also make a travel version. And it's just like the little tap on the thing. You just like tap it to the temperature you want or through the app, and there you go.
All right.
That's where I'm at.
Well, I have no idea the reasons why, but I know that matcha green tea, the best temperature for it, or at least the prescribed temperature for matcha, is 175. It's apparently the optimal temperature for it. No idea why, but that would make for an interesting matcha consumption experience to have it
Yeah.
always at 175, because once it's obviously hitting the
It's,
mug, it's cooling down.
yeah, especially if you care about the drink you have. Like, we're just sitting here at our desks a lot of the day. So it gives you this opportunity to, you're just like, this is the place I wanted. Like, I don't, I'm past this place where I'm just drinking McDonald's coffee in my life. I was like, yeah, I only get a couple. That's what you just said before. And I want them to be kind of special. And so, like, I grind the beans, like, nah. And I just want it to feel like a special experience. So this, I don't think there's a level after this, to tell you the truth. This
Well,
is as high as it goes.
this is peak.
Other than having a guy, which I don't think I'm gonna ever get a guy.
You know, there is a, yeah, there's something to be said for that. Once it cools down, the drink does. I mean, it's like, I don't know, a third of the enjoyment when you're drinking a cold matcha or cold coffee, if not less. And I've tried the Yeti tumblers to keep it warm, but I've never heard I've heard of those Ember mugs, but I had never heard that they will precisely keep it at a certain temperature. That's That's freaking
brilliant. The guy who does the YouTube review, he actually says, warning, if you buy this, people will make fun of you and you will deserve it. With that in mind, this is a great mug.
I think you had me sold at the $195 thing. I thought it just, and you want me to really share the below the line version of what's going through my head is.
That's why I'm here.
My mother-in-law offered to get me one of those for Christmas. And I said, no, because I just thought it was a warmer. So I was like, no. I don't need that.
No, she must love you enough.
Yeah.
And maybe she's listening. She must love you enough that she gets you the special one.
Yeah.
And you choose your color and everything. They make the copper one.
Oh, damn. Yeah. So I'm going to be looking into these Ember mugs. Yeah. Outside of what's on your desk right now with a $15,000 self-heating mug. Just kidding. It's probably not that much. But what else is on your desk today is CEO now back in the trenches with early stage. Before we get into high level, anything just deeper, I want to know, like, literally, what were you up to today or right before this we hit record?
Yeah. So this, I have an Aeron chair behind me, which is one of those classic .com Herman Miller chairs. So I've got a Kindle. The Kindle I use to typically my daytime reading is my nonfiction reading. In the evening, you want your mind to kind of cool down, sort of. So then I'm reading, like, whatever, you know, detective novels or something. I've been buying the same notepad book, which are, they're called Stalogy, and they're Japanese, I think. I've got this perfect, probably can't see it, but like that level of real amazing hex, not hex, but square in it. I've been buying that same book for years from a place.
How come? Why that one?
Because of the perfect, God, everything, dude. The book has, if I just find a, he lets you sort of circle the date here. And so it's got it's just magic.
What's the brand?
And when you find something, like, you just want to buy it again and again and again. And I just think it has that level of refinement. Because I used to write books for a living, not just for that, but just in general, I have a tremendous amount of respect for, like, pen and paper and the power of the written word and a bunch of things like that. So this is almost like a little religious thing that I have. Like, it's about ritual, right?
You carry it everywhere?
I do. I carry one everywhere that I go. I've also got these weird postcards. This is the first time I'm telling people online about this.
Yes. Yes.
I've been getting these mystery postcards from people. I don't know where they're from. I mean this. I've gotten a lot of them.
Okay, wait. Explain that.
So these are all postcards, and they're all from the same set of, like, men's fashion wear. And I
it would appear so. You know,
the mystery sender wants me to talk about this on the internet, I'm sure, actually. So, and then every single one of them has, like, a quote from a poet on. It's actually good. I cover my, because this is my address on the other side, so yeah. I don't want to show that. Smart. But you see, it's this one came from the UK. Mm-hmm. It's got a UK postage stamp, airmail, and a quote from, in this case, maybe Rumi. A lot of them are Rumi quotes, but sometimes they're like another poet. And I have gotten I'm completely serious about this. Like, I've gotten them from Germany. I've gotten them from,
and it's all the same person sending you these.
Canada. I've gotten them from, so someone's playing an amazing practical joke on me that's, like, next level. I'm never going to talk about this online. Is this the one place I'm going to talk about it online?
Yes, thank you.
And I keep talking to people about this. Like, I'm trying to figure out if it's you, by the way, James. I swear to God, I don't know what I'm going
to
do.
Dude, I wish I had that elaborate of a mind to think. That is a brilliant prank.
That exact quote is what everybody says.
Yeah.
They're like, this is really good. I wish I had done it, but I don't have the time. That's what everybody says.
That is pretty good.
And so either they're all in on it. So this has been happening for, like, weeks. Several weeks.
And this person, well, obviously they must be traveling quite a lot, or...
Or it's a group of people that are doing it together all at once, right? And they've got, like, some kind of plan about what they're doing.
Do you have team members in these countries?
So I don't have anyone in the UK. I have someone in Austria. My team is distributed. I have some people in other parts of Europe, like Serbia. I have some people in Latin America. So the answer is sometimes, but not in every city. Like one of them came from Winnipeg, which is a city in Canada. But there are no people that I know from Winnipeg. Well, my co-founder's from Winnipeg. But then, so anyway, it's an elaborate thing that's going on here. And I kind of sometimes feel my teammates know about this. I sometimes feel like all my teammates are doing this to me together, and they're all lying to me at the same time.
I think we are getting close, getting warmer.
Yeah.
Ember
And
mug
as you know,
style. Yeah.
I get a lot. I send a lot of postcards. You might have received a postcard
I
from me.
have, but I didn't know that that
Yeah.
was part of your shtick. That and it,
My shtick. Yeah,
I
it is.
remember being really impressed by that and thinking to myself, I should send more postcards.
Because they're a magical thing to receive. It's true. And they're handwritten. So it is a thing. I collect people's addresses, people that I know or that I work with or whatever. And I'll try to write it in one fell swoop, bam, bam, bam. And I never really think about it. It's just whatever happens to be in the moment. I write the address, boom, I send it off. So I'm always carrying stamps with me and other things like that. So you see, just you asked me what was on my desk.
Yeah,
So
keep going
I
through
got a bunch
everything.
of stamps that I always have. Then I'm renewing my passport because I'm taking a trip for the first time in a super long time. I'm going to Spain to get tattooed. And then the Ember mug. And that's about it on my desk here.
Okay, so just to go slowly through these before we move on to maybe more interesting things, but this is, I think there's something really fascinating about each one of these items. So with the notepad, what do you keep it for? And then I also want to know about the more about the reason for sending people postcards. But starting with the notepad, is it just to-do lists? Is it journal? What
Yeah.
do you use it
So
for?
there's an importance to the empty page, right? So when you have an empty page, every day gets a page, and I'm like, that freshness lets me feel like I have a clean slate to think. And then sometimes, because I run a coaching software company called Practice, which we'll talk about, I'm sure. But it also means that today, these days, I coach first-time CEOs. And so my coaching notes go from here. I take a photo of them and then I upload them into our software at practice.do. And so big portion of these are coaching notes. And then I think the important thing is really actually just kind of to have a record of thoughts sometime. And so I'll go back to, oh, I had a good idea. And I'll just kind of like look through old. I have a lot of records of things that I'm thinking or things. Ways that I'm trying to solve a problem as I go. And I like going back to see how was I thinking then or what was I thinking about?
Really, I hate going back. I never go back.
I probably do too much. Like it's a lot of rumination.
Yeah, please tell me more why. How do you do it methodically, or is it just kind of like spur of the moment when it hits you go back and look?
I think I'm trying to figure out the story, the thread that is going forwards in time and that has like, okay, so this is Julian's story as it's happening, but what are the things that are in common? So for example, I also write 1,000 words a day freehand. Well, sorry, free writing that used to be by hand, and now it's always on a program I use called OmWriter. And
What's it called?
Om Writer, OMM, like
Okay.
Om. And so I write 1,000 words a day and I never, typically, almost never look at it again. Now, I will go back in time sometimes to like, let's say 3 years ago today. And I'll look at that and I'll be like, where was I in my life? What did I write and what was I thinking about then? And so I have a lot of this stuff that I can do looking back. Which kind of gives me a sense of, oh, I cared about those things 5 years ago, and I still care about them now. I'm probably going to care about them 5 years from now. So it gives me a little bit of a kind of almost like outside view of my own story and my own like thought patterns, whether negative or positive or whatever. So I get a better view on myself, almost like from the outside, even though it's me observing myself. I'm observing my past self.
Dude, I knew you were an interesting guy, and that's why I was excited for this conversation. But this is already 10 minutes in, and it's exceeding my expectations. So what are some of the things that you've noticed as you look back and reflect on what you've written in the past? Yeah.
So for example, I used to have a lot of internal conflict about feeling like everything that I did was commercial and nothing, because I grew up when I went to college, which I eventually dropped out of, there's a portion of time where I was in fine arts and I was studying to do, I mean, it sounds bigger than it is, but like studying art and studying specifically, I wanted to do metal sculpture at the time. And so I would look at certain sections of my life and be like, and that was a commercial success. This was a commercial thing. And this was another commercial thing. And look back at it, be like, but why do I do all these commercial things when what I wanted to do then was to do something like artistic?
Hmm.
And so that gives me a kind of sense of, oh, okay, did I do things right or whatever? And now the way that I feel actually is, oh no, I'm really just really good at commercial things. So that is like the kind of thing that I needed to do looking back and be able to get a sense of myself. And another thing, earlier you asked me, I do a lot of rumination. You said something, and I said, yeah, I do a lot of rumination. Mm-hmm. That self-reflection and that kind of like obsession with, am I doing things right? So it's kind of like, it's just a way to see what I'm doing and be able to almost like track it, but in a loose way.
Yeah.
It is also a very deep, important ritual that allows me to make sure I start my day off right.
That's the 1,000 words.
1,000 words every day. 1,000 words. I wake up, it didn't used to be in the Ember mug, but you know, Ember mug now, and 1,000 words a day about whatever I have in my mind with no judgment. And so that way it's almost like it's free of any, you know, it's free of like, it's never getting any likes, right? Mm. It's like there's a lot of stuff you get that needs likes or wants likes these days. And this is like, it's never going to get any likes. It's out there. It's just like the things in the notebook, never going to be likes. And that kind of gives it a certain purity almost.
When was the last time you looked at one from the past?
It has certainly been, it's probably been years.
Oh, really?
Like a year or 2 years, but I can go back all the way to my first venture back company, Breather, which I ran for a number of years as CEO. And I can go back even further than that to probably around 2011. And I have records for every day. Bam, 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 bam. I would say 8 out of 10 days, probably.
This is like a Tarantino film where we're starting at the end of the story today and we will get to the chronology, but, I wouldn't be doing my job for the listeners if I didn't at least ask, and you don't feel free to not share it, but what were some of your thoughts going through your head this morning, that at least the ones that you remember that you're writing about?
From this morning?
Mm-hmm. If you remember them.
From this morning, I remember being just kind of out of it psychologically, but actually, you know, let me just literally bring it up.
Mind. Man, and this couldn't be a better conversation, a below the line conversation. If a writer, a really articulate writer, spends 1,000 hours.
Right. I mean, don't expect high standards.
Yes. Yes.
I wrote something about building versus writing. I said, oh man, I talked about how I want to draw actually a lot more than I currently do. Cause I used to want to be a concept artist in my early 20s. Mm. And, I talk a little bit about, want to understand my goals more, because I used to, when I ran my first company, I'm talking about kind of life goals. Mm-hmm. I had a very clear set of goals. And since then I was like, am I still aligned to the goals that I want to have? Mm-hmm. Then I wrote about doing angel investing checks and if I should increase my check size, because I've had a few things that have been successful. Mm-hmm. And it just goes on and on and on like this. Like we're hiring an onboarding person. So I talked about that. So it just goes on and on, just like page after page of page of just free writing, going back years.
Wow. And in just a few sentences on each kind of part and parcel.
Literally, the idea, it comes from Julia Cameron, a book called The Artist's Way, which is pretty popular and came out in the 80s or 90s. And this book, the objective is to have non-judgmental writing to get out of, I guess, maybe writer's block or something. It's a lot about writing. And I found that if I kept doing it, I would get clear about like what mattered to me today, or what I want to prioritize, or what was bothering me. And I, because it's judgment free and because it kind of sits in this kind of like attic on my computer, I will write anything. And sometimes I feel like, oh my God, what if someone finds these? They're, it's like weird fetish things or whatever. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, there are this, it's personal thoughts. And so it is the privacy of them, and the fact that they happen in a closed space gives them a safety that I think most people don't often have with themselves, with their own almost like self-censorship. That I feel that I would, like, you wouldn't talk to yourself out loud for like the equivalent of half an hour. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't talk to a someone without some level of self-censorship, but this gives you a certain openness.
Yeah, is there something about OMM that makes it a special place to do it in?
The app gives you a beautiful background, and it's like a beautiful kind of like white or black background with like, you know, like an ocean or like a mountain or something.
Oh, cool.
So it's like, again, just like in The Notebook, it's about a free open space to kind of be able to express like a pure set of thoughts or something like that.
Is it password protected and things like that? Or is it like kind of built for these?
I mean, my computer is password protected.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not on the cloud. Right.
Right. So, oh, it's not. Okay. Well,
no, it's not on the cloud. Yeah.
Yeah. What, one of my favorite philosophers, A. Parthasarathian, Indian philosophers, is very key on, he's pretty loud on this point of, reading. The levels of understanding go from reading to speaking to writing. If you can really mm-hmm. write your thoughts, then that's when you know you really understand mm-hmm. what you're even thinking. So that's that sounds like a great exercise. Okay.
I suggest it to anyone listening to this. It's a great idea.
Before we get off this topic, are there any other rituals that you have found to be quite useful in your life, busy life of running companies?
Yeah, so I will definitely say that the 1,000 words is for sure the most valuable one, and that I've kept doing for the longest. But I'm also a person who, by, like, if you were just to, I don't know, like, you know, I just finished rewatching the Harry Potter series. You know how everyone has like a Patronus, like a charm, and it emerges as a certain animal or something. Mine would be probably naturally very chaotic and kind of all over the place, and so because of that, I instill structure, I impose structure on myself that allows kind of like the animal to go loose. But because it's my own structure, it helps me achieve anything at all, probably, right? And so the 1,000 words is a very meaningful one. I also, for many years, I was like, okay, I always work out 3 days a week. And I used to fast, and I mostly do fast till noon, for the majority of let's say the past decade or something, till noon or 2 p.m. or something like that. And so there's a lot of stuff that the essence of it is really to give me some almost like guidelines to be able to live life properly. Another one is the GTD, getting things done methodology, mm-hmm. which allows for a weekly review on Sundays. So every Sunday I've got this meta level review of life or projects. And both me and my fiance do it actually together, and we look at our stuff and we're like, this is the stuff that matters. Are we advancing it enough? It started seeming a little crazy, but it's actually like a really fluid and it works. And then the last one is me and my fiance do a weekly check-in about our relationship, which seems wild to most people. No. But it comes from a well-known psychologist called John Gottman, sorry, he's a therapist and relationship counselor, who talks about the four horsemen of the divorce is one thing that he talks about. And so he is famous for knowing how to be able to watch people on video, having interviewed them, and then being able to predict divorce 10 years later. So that's what John Gottman is famous for. And one of the things he states is, in one of the books, I think it's called How to Make Love Last or something. And so what we do is we get together. It's actually weird that I'm admitting this. I don't really talk about
this is great.
On the internet. Yeah, but it's strange to me. It's like weirdly confessional.
It's just you and me, Julian. No one's listening. Just you and me.
So we get together. One person owns the meeting every week. It trades sides. Mm-hmm. And one person's job is to be the speaker and to talk about an issue that gets them. And the other person's job is to non-defensively listen. And so it allows for a safe space for someone to say, you never do the dishes. I don't get why you don't do them or whatever it is. And for the other person to be like, wow, that sounds like it really bothers you. Yeah, fuck, it really bothers me. I don't understand why you can't just do it. I do so much around the house or whatever. And the other person is like, yeah, that you sound like you really heard about that, you know? And so there's a specific structure for this type of meeting that is intended to practice non-defensive listening and practice non-attacking speaking while doing your thing. And so it, by doing it on a really consistent basis, it allows you to kind of open up to be able to have difficult conversations and have them more regularly so they are not so high pressure and so that they do not produce what we would you might call flooding, which is psychological language for getting overwhelmed with emotion and losing your shit in some way or another.
Yeah.
Like crying or getting angry, or this what flooding is, or shutting down, stonewalling. Right. So practicing having tough conversations without those things occurring.
That's interesting. And you said the two aspects would be What was the side for the speaker to keep in mind, and what was the side for the listener to keep in mind?
Yeah, you can actually look this up. There's the heuristic for it is ATTUNE. I can't believe we're talking about this, but it's awareness, turning criticisms into wishes, and tolerance on the speaker side. And on the listener side, it's UNE. So understanding, non-defensive listening, and empathy. And you can look this up. It's like a famous thing. But every week you spend no more than 1 hour or less doing this. And it's honestly like, I was talking to somebody and they were like, seems like a lot. I'd be like, it does seem like a lot. But over a long relationship, like, you know, people, like all kinds of things happen and all sorts of baggage emerges and people get angry about all kinds of things.
Right.
And so it's almost like it's a healthy dynamic
relief valve.
Get it to open up a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, if that sounds like a lot, then it's pick your poison. It sounds like, you know, it's
right. Yeah.
A flourishing relationship or one that slowly but surely goes dormant because of a lack of these things being discussed. Yeah. And what are the odds? The acronym spells ATTUNE. Okay.
Yeah,
so
that's incredibly coincidental.
What a coincidence. I mean, okay. So, If I were to recast this back of the importance of something like this, it sounds like for the couple, it's a really valuable practice to have this exercise where you're constantly thinking about how you're speaking, to where you're not. Mm-hmm. I imagine after a few of these sessions, statements that you made as kind of like the fake version would rarely come up of you never do the dishes. Like I would imagine after a few of these, the speaker realizes, oh, don't screw over this dynamic and energy by saying you never do the dishes.
It doesn't mean that you become perfect, right? So again, we're back to structure to prevent the animal from going loose a little bit. And the structure of the few things that this is called. It's sometimes called a State of the Union meeting, or it's called a check-in, or it's et cetera. And the objective is like the structure, and thinking about the structure allows you to avoid the typical like tensing up that two people would do when they're talking about a hard thing.
After a month or two of doing this, would you or your fiance say things like, you never do the dishes? Or would there be a reframing of that type of thought or sentiment that would happen as you practice this approach?
It allows you to get better at the same way some people talk about meditation as being something that allows them to step back from the feeling. The feeling is still happening, but it's happening to a layer almost like behind you or in front of you. It's not happening to you as much. Similarly, you're like, okay, you feel the instinct, and there's another kind of, and then you try to not respond, or you'd respond with I language versus you language, which is classic relationship thing that people say. And then there's a good thing that once you get used to this, you could actually be like, I'm flooding. And when you say I'm flooding, it's like a way of self-awareness being able to say, this conversation is about to go off the rails, but it's not because of you, it's because of me. I need a break in regular everyday world, right? I'm flooding. I need 5 minutes and leave, like come back, have the con I'm sorry about, I just kind of lost it when you said no. That really brings up a lot of stuff for me, you know. It's hilarious that we're talking about this,
No, it's this is
but no, almost nobody does it, right?
you're right.
Almost nobody does it.
No one talks about this type of stuff, especially not on a business podcast. And who are we if not for the relationships we have, keep or lose? So this stuff is endlessly fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's also like if you run it, it's different with a business that's remote, because at my last business, and I remember we were both in this world, we were both operators at that time, like it was like a big office and you were away from the house a lot of the time. If you run a remote company, and then so you're closer physically and emotionally closer to your significant other more often, and so your relationship being bad or good is going to be more meaningful when you just go into the next room and then bam, like not me, I don't have kids, but like damn, there's your relationship or there's your kids, or like so you it's I don't know, you got to be more mindful maybe about it. For me, this is something that has had a very meaningful positive impact for me. Doesn't mean it's for everyone.
Well, I bet a lot of people in the last 2 years have had to reassess that living dynamic, because it is now for many of us our work dynamic as well, like you just said. Are there any aspects of this that you borrow and take into running practice? Which, full disclosure for listeners, I am an investor in practice. I've known Julian for a few years. I am such a fan of what you're building, but it's really of you as like I've said now twice already, just as an individual, a fascinating, thoughtful individual on a level that is I rarely experience. So all of that out of the way, are there any aspects of this that you've taken into running practice?
I mean, we definitely, I will say something about this is my second time working with my co-founder, Ben Neville. And we worked together. He was a CTO, not the co-founder, but the CTO at Breather for the longest period of time. And so we worked together for probably 5 years or something there. And then we've been working together for two something years at practice together. And I will say that feedback and being able to have a sort of emotionally mature conversation is so integral to our relationships as co-founders that I couldn't imagine not having it now. And so the try to sort of generalize an example. Ben came to me And I had said something like during a meeting, like at some point last week or whatever. And he was like, "What the hell was that?" Because it's interesting. Often a CEO or CEO to CTO relationship is the CEO is the impatient one, the CTO has the roadmap, and the CTO has to be like patient and thoughtful about what gets on the roadmap and so on. So probably it was something that where I was like flippantly saying something. He texts me afterwards or sends me a message afterwards, like, "What the hell was this?" Here, what happens is it's, I deliberately I see the message. I'm like, I'm only going to respond to this the next day. The next day, he comes back to me. He says, "You haven't responded to my message." I said, "Yes, I slept on it on purpose." He says, "That was probably a good idea because how I was feeling here was like this. I appreciate you sleeping on it because that helps our relationship more." I go, "Yeah, and you're probably right about da da da." So we have this really healthy, kind of emotionally mature conversation around a touchy subject. And then at the end of these conversations, we always say, "I want to let you know I really appreciate the relationship that we have, and I treasure it and the way that we work together." Now I don't say this like as a ritual, but I really mean it. I remember exactly how we said it. He says it sometimes, I said it sometimes. And it's because like when you have bad working relationships with people, it's a nightmare. It's like a fucking nightmare. And so to have a good one is incredibly valuable, and it takes a lot of the bad stuff of working with another person very closely out of the equation. We've had a number of arguments before in the past, mostly at our prior company, right? Now we come to work together again. I know his stupid shit that he does. He knows my stupid shit that I do. And we come together to be able to try and say, "Okay, so you know how you have a tendency to give people too many chances or something. So you need to work against that here because I think that blah, 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 blah." That's not applicable to anyone in my business today, but it's like to give you a sense, right? And so a similar self-aware, I think, I would say meaningfully emotionally mature dynamic, I try to have happen in my relationship. Now it takes the two of us on that side to willingly do it. And with my co-founder. And again, we both willingly need to do it and we willingly need to contribute to it. And so it is, that's true that that's the case. And actually, like, we deliberately try to hire for that as well and begin conversations with, "Give me some feedback about," or, "It was my first month at the company. Like, what do you think about my first month? How did it go? What else can I do to improve?" That kind of dialogue, certainly among my team, is really valuable, and I think throughout the company in general.
Well, as you're speaking, I'm thinking about just the analog of, or at least the adage of, eat a bit of poison each day, and then you inoculate yourself from it. Have these conversations often and frequently, and then they become easier and easier. The
I think that's true.
I think, it also reminds me of just building software has taught me, in software design, when you do it after a while, you just know that the faster the iterations, the better the software gets. Not the more perfect the iterations, but, I don't know what Encyclopedia Britannica being a CD-ROM every year and Wikipedia being updated 15,000 times a day, it's it you're just going to end up with much better software the faster, more frequently that these changes are occurring. And similarly with relationships, it's probably something similar. If a better relationship, the faster you have these, or more frequently you have these conversations and get this
Yeah, I really
feedback.
believe that. It's, you know, and it's not as if you are perfect at all. Like, it's fine. I don't know. Sometimes I think about like, how am I coming off? Am I coming off? Like, I come off sometimes if I'm talking to people in this environment, like I've got this perfect structure. I also wrote a couple of books that are kind of related to this. I wrote a book, Flinch, which has like a big, even today, 10 years later, like a really meaningful audience where people are like, "Oh my God, this," like I'll get emails, "This book changed my life." Nah, nah. And that's very nice. But I worry about coming off like I have, like I'm so incredibly flawed, you know, I'm so flawed. But I think in some of these perspectives, like I sometimes feel like I come off really like I've got this all figured out. Like I'm really not. Like it's incredible work in progress with a lot of fuck ups, but I'm just super interested in making this life, my life, worthwhile. Now, what does that mean? I don't know, you know, but it's definitely to get that feedback. And maybe that's what part of it is. Maybe that's what the free writing is about. And then note taking and like all these things and the weekly review. And it's almost like, how are we doing? Are we on track? Are we on track? You know, to be able to get closer to whatever it is, you know?
What is a worthwhile? So you mentioned the perfect segue into your background of being New York Times bestselling writer, and I'm gonna take that bait and go into that segue. But but you mentioned worthwhile life. What is a worthwhile life to you?
I can't say for others, but I can say that I was blessed with opportunities to do a lot of super ambitious stuff, to speak and connect regularly with incredibly talented and smart people, and people that have an opportunity to themselves make a really big difference. I got a taste early on of being able to influence people's lives and have a meaningful effect on their lives in my early, like, mid-20s. And I was like, man, I really like this. But I will say at the same time, there's something super pure. I have another place that I'm in Canada at the moment. I haven't crossed the border in a while since the pandemic began. But before that, I was back and forth, United States and Canada, like Los Angeles, SF, New York, all these places. But now I have a place on Vancouver Island right by the ocean, a place called Tofino, which is like a surf town. And I will say that there's incredible purity for me to nature and the ocean you don't really need that much. So there's a part of me, I feel that especially when I'm in a city or when I'm talking to others that are building crazy things and that are out there making a big impact in stuff I care about, which is like tech and software and like culture to a degree because of books and things, I'm like, wow, this is so exciting. I want to be involved in this. I want to do more of this. And I feel that way when I'm coaching people too. I feel like I'm making a certain impact in their lives, especially because they run software companies. And so they themselves have their own careers and success trajectory. And then there's a part of me that's just like, I disappear into the woods in the primeval forest of like Vancouver Island, Canada. And I'm like, wow, this is amazing. Again, no likes, no nothing. Just like me in the ocean. And it rains there a lot. It's like crazy amounts of rain. And it's super beautiful. And so in my notes, I sometimes... I have a, you know, everything's a to-do list. It's like kind of a weird thing to say, but I have a reminder to myself that says, have you experienced the sacred recently? And the reason I have that reminder is to be like, yo, it's not just about building a piece of software and making it to help people. It's also about kind of the purity of isolation and like doing something that you want for its own sake and all these other things. So it's almost like I have two different versions of myself that they're not in conflict with one another, but I need to satisfy both of them in order to do well for myself and to be happy, I think.
Imagine this. You're launching your subscription product and you need to invoice your first few customers. You integrate with a payment gateway, write some code to support recurring billing, and you start charging things up. Stuff seems to work until you need to create tax compliant invoices or set up flexible trials and run pricing experiments. Yikes. Or integrate with more than one gateway. Yoinks! Billing needs grow as business needs grow. Every line of code you write for your billing system contributes to the spaghetti nightmare that will keep you away from your core product. Don't do that. ChargeBee is here to help. We replace in-house billing systems and spreadsheets by giving teams the ability to set up subscription plans and trials, run pricing experiments at scale, analyze accurate subscription analytics, accept multiple payment methods, and much, much more right out of the box. ChargeBee works with global payment gateways like Stripe, Braintree, PayPal, everybody, and integrates with essential tools like HubSpot, Baremetrics, Xero, QuickBooks, Salesforce, and much more. ChargeBee, ChargeBee, ChargeBee. The journey to the first million is often the hardest. To help you get there faster, we're offering free access to ChargeBee's Rise plan. This offer is valid until you hit your first million dollars in revenue. This is a meeting that goes back 2 weeks ago. Me and the CEO, I said, this isn't enough at 500K. This isn't enough at 750. This offer should be valid until customers hit their first million in revenue. And that's how we came to this decision. So you don't have to worry about billing and subscription management in the marathon that is running your business. To avail the services. Love that. I'm going to start using that phrase as often as possible. To avail the services. Sign up for a ChargeBee account with the link in our show notes for chargebee.com/partners. Sign up and enter your details with the coupon code BTL for below the line BTL. And then you complete your sign up within seconds. Super easy. ChargeBee rocks. For listeners that might not know who your background and what you've done, Julian, do you mind giving folks an overview, maybe just chronologically, of of what's gotten you here to today, starting one of the more important companies that I think anyone is building with practice? Yeah.
So I don't come from, unlike a lot of people that you'll see out here, I don't know, on the internet that have succeeded in any way, I'm like no Stanford degree, no YC, no like literally any of these things. My father was a career coach and an exec coach, but very much like a self-starter, and was from Saskatchewan, where he used to teach at a one room school. And my mom was a secretary. And so I grew up without and didn't get a college degree. And so my world was very small for a really long time until I started podcasting in 2004, which I was one of the first people to ever podcast in the world. Yeah, this is weird to say, but I ran the first hip hop podcast that ever existed. Like, that's actually the truth of what happened. It got picked up by Sirius Satellite Radio. Mm-hmm. And so because it got picked up by Sirius Satellite Radio, all of a sudden it was like, I was like the talent a little bit. And I ran my own show, and I got like kind of it's my first access to the internet from in a strict like international sense. And then all of a sudden I had a well-known blog, and then people gave me a book deal, and I was under 30 and I co-wrote a book with Chris Brogan. I wrote a few books with him that ended up being one of the first, or maybe the first social media marketing book in the world. It was called Trust Agents. It was a New York Times bestseller in 2009. I wrote two more books, including that book Flinch and some others. And I kept blogging, and I had a very popular blog on self-improvement for a really long time, which is still there at inoveryourhead.net.
And real quick, were you always hyper-productive? Writing is such an arduous...
This sounds like I'm hyper-productive, but I'm actually not. It's just I did it for a long time. And because I did it for a long time, it seems hyper-productive. But I was always interested in doing the most with the time I had, right? Mm-hmm. And to prioritizing things that I felt would make a difference, and where I could progressively build almost like a body of work over time. And so that I've always kind of like had, and when I had access to be able to, for example, to start a podcast, I was like, it was weird because I was a customer service agent by day, this really happened. And then by night, I would come home at 2 o'clock in the morning, I had a night shift. At 3 o'clock, I'd be home in the morning, and I'd record one of these podcasts, and it would go the next day on Sirius Satellite Radio, And I had like a deal, like people advertised on my podcast, and so all of a sudden I could quit my job, and I all of a sudden I was like, oh, this is I could build something here, you know. And but I had never really experienced that before, and so I guess I was just fascinated by this idea of being able to reach a lot of people, or to have an impact beyond like the everyday, you know. So then eventually, after writing a bunch of books, then this is when I had an idea for Breather, which is my first venture backed company. It was a real estate tech startup. I raised a little bit of money and then a lot of money to get to around 150 million or so raised. I had a team of about 250 people at the height of it. We had things in 10 cities. Then I realized I didn't love real estate, but I was running a real estate company. And we hired me and the board together, hired an outside CEO to manage it. And then I took some time off and I started another venture-backed company. That's what I run today, which is Practice, which is funded by Andreessen Horowitz, by a number of smart angel investors like yourself. The trajectory chronologically is that. The trajectory from the perspective of the thread that connects them all is empowering people that are underpowered. And that's really what it's kind of, for me, always been about from a motivation perspective.
Within a few of these parts of the story, specifically with starting with writing, what is the internal psychology like for a writer, for you? If you want to keep it to your experience or what you've noticed with other writers, writing a book and much less a few and writing a New York Times bestseller, it sounds 30,000 miles away from any one of us. So far away, untouchable territory. And I'm sure there are many great writers out there that have a lot of great ideas to share that are probably quite daunted by putting together thoughts into a book. What would you say to, if you were to look back at yourself when you first started to entertain the idea, what would you say to that younger version of you setting out to write a book, and much less having the chops to write a book that would end up becoming a New York Times bestseller, right? The very foothills of that journey.
So I would say that it is remarkably about just producing a ritual for yourself that you can keep up with. There was a set of weird things that I did when I was a writer, including, this is a very strange thing that that Hunter Thompson did, who's a well-known, what's the type of journalism?
Gonzo
journalist, yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. So he's a gonzo journalist. And in order to learn to write well, he copied Herman Melville's Moby Dick. Like, he would just read it, like literally read it. And as he was reading it, he would copy the words. He did that for the whole book. And I did this as one form of practice for how to become a writer. But in reality, just to every day, just sit down and write just anything at all is just the most valuable thing that you can do. And that eventually you discover your voice. You discover that you have a voice, whatever it is. And when you figure this out, this is when people really start to connect with what you do. Because there has to be an element of truth to it. And if there's no truth to it, it will not, well, maybe out there, I don't know. But for me, to connect with an authentic inner voice, that is how I was able to find an audience for the stuff that I wrote, but more importantly, to write the stuff that I was personally most proud of. The stuff that I felt could, that really felt like I was, sometimes I joke around and I say, earn the oxygen that I breathe, right? I felt like I was earning the oxygen that I breathe by doing work that could have a positive impact on people and that really matched up with my inner self.
And what do you mean by finding a voice? Because you hear people talk about this, artists, comedians, writers. Yeah. What does that mean?
There's some version of you that is where you strip away the stuff that is surface, that's all like the superego, like the collective consciousness telling you what to do and not do, right? And so that collective consciousness that's like smashing you down and telling you to become ABC or whatever. Some people it's like be a lawyer or a doctor. For someone else, it's something else. So every time that you write or that you produce work that is what someone else wants you to do, you're it's almost like you're mimicking something, right? Like the objective for Hunter Thompson was to copy the words of Moby Dick so that he could find something that then became his own voice over time, and which arguably is he had done. And so to find that inner version that is the real you takes some time to deconstruct your the almost like the barriers. This is the work, what is it called? The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. There's a well-known book about
Been
this.
on the
There's a number of
podcast.
them.
Yeah. Yeah, he's
Yeah,
yeah, he has.
yeah.
Yeah. He's yeah, it's a phenomenal book.
Right. And pretty short. The view is go out and you make an authentic thing that is your that is a good representation of you. And when you find it, when it is a good representation of you, naturally people are drawn to it because people are drawn to truth, right? They're not just drawn to truth, but it's one of the things that they're drawn to. That's what they mean when because comedians they will show you something and they'll show you a truth, and then that truth feels like real and exposed, and that's the thing that people connect to, right? So like that's what good writing is, and that's what a voice is.
Do you remember? Can you give a practical example to help just articulate this further of things that you would write that weren't your voice, and then something where you wrote it and you're like, shit, that is my voice. Or times when you were writing and you were taking it, ostensibly taking it seriously, but you knew it wasn't your voice. And then is it something you just find like 3 years in? And it's like you hit the 10,000 hours or whatever the milestone is, and the artifice falls away.
Yeah, so it is not easily like you don't just randomly find it and then you're writing perfectly all the time. That's not how it works. It's more like you have a like you have a craft and your craft has gotten progressively good. The example that comes to mind is like Flinch, the short book that I wrote, was edited by Seth Godin. And Godin worked on it with me for a long time. And he was like, this is getting better. He's like, this part, we were both in the Google Drive, like really working on it together. And then he was like, this is pretty good, Julian, but do you want a book that's good, or do you want a book that you are in where you are in awe of what you have written? I was like, well, I don't know how to do that. And Helen, we were together then, it was over 10 years ago, we've been together for a long time. I was in the backyard like screaming. I was like, I don't know how to do that. Like, I don't know. But it
And
was
this
just
is on, and this
relentless,
is, and this is
like.
on the other side of a New York Times bestseller. This is on the
Yes,
other
it's
side of
after
two
a New
other.
York Times bestseller. Yeah, that's right. And to have and then having written that book, so that's the book that people are like, they email me even today and they're like, that your book saved my life, like da 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 da. Like, that's what that book is. And I had to like basically like sacrifice enough of myself to be able to find something that was really authentic like that and that resonated in a really raw way with people. So sometimes it's not like you find it and then you have it. Like you find it, you lose it. You have it some of the time when you're writing, you lose it some of the other time when you're writing. It's true for everything, you know.
Yeah. So I get it. It's or at least it sounds like it's, yeah, it's not like Excalibur, you pull it out of the stone, you've got it forever. It's it,
Right.
especially with what you're saying of it's the process or the ritual that you develop.
Yeah. You
And
also might hate having it. That's the other thing. You might not like the thing that you you have made or while you're in the process of making it.
What do you mean?
And it might not feel good to you because it's exposing a part of you that you don't want to expose.
Oh.
Right?
And say more about that.
Because it's your real self, that's a part of you that you hide from others because it makes you feel safe to hide it. Right, you hide it, and you're programmed to become like a certain type of person by society, by your family, by everybody with good intentions, and so you only with a great deal of work do you like expose this version of yourself. I think Stephen Pressfield would say the same thing, but then once you have it, you're like, oh, there it is, okay, but you might. It might feel, you might be afraid of writing it, writing something like this, right? You might be afraid to publish something like this.
Could you say, I'm fascinated about this part of the creation process. So that's why I'm pursuing this topic so much, but could you say if you're excited to write about it or if you're intrinsically excited to put it out there, then it probably is not the vulnerable truth that is your own voice.
I can't say for other people, but I definitely can say that this comes from a French writer, Hélène Cizou. There's a book, really weird book called Three Steps on the Ladder of Writing. And it's like, it's French, right? So it's completely psychotic. It's like, good writing involves death and sacrifice. Mm. It's like, it says shit like that, but there is an element of truth to it. Right. Hmm. Like in order to write a book that I was very proud of, I had to like sacrifice like a lot. It took some of my life essence. And that's why it still resonates with people out there.
One of my favorite, as you're saying that, a good example, one of my favorite podcasters and comedians is this guy, Theo Von. And where I with my own professional persistence, I have become somewhat friends with him over the years, and a lot of cold emails and persistence there. But there's such an admiration for his creations and his podcasting. Within the first 20 seconds of the first podcast I heard of his, I remember him saying that he goes, 3 months off of masturbating, I feel pretty good. And this is in a comedy podcast, have no idea, and really completely unexpected that he mentioned something like that.
Yeah.
But I was so hooked of like, holy shit, if that's the depths of his candor that he's willing to share.
That's right.
Or if that's just the first 20 seconds that he's willing to share, the depths that he is willing to share openly is going to blow the doors off of certainly any other podcast I had heard in the preceding months.
This is not a political thing, just to be clear, but there's like a reason that people connect with people like Joe Rogan. And that's the last mention of Joe Rogan that there will be in this podcast, to be clear. But like there people connect with this authentic, raw thing, right? And they're like, oh my God, I can't get enough of it. It's also why people connect with Howard Stern. And it's just like people are like, I can't believe this. Like, it's so real, right? And there's just not that much of that in real life, especially as you get this Instagram version of everything, which is like polished and like reality is very attractive and
and universal.
It's compelling because there's so much fakeness out there, right?
Okay, so you go from writing to building a massive business and raising $150 million for a breather. Walk us through that, just that the internal psychology and that arc of being a successful writer and creating media for a long time and then saying, okay, I'm going to build a software real estate business, and what that traversal was like as a creator.
Well, the first thing is I had never actually done a real thing. in my life, like I'd actually like done something versus talk about it. Because keep in mind, I begin, most people do the opposite. They start with, they become a successful na na na. And then once they become that thing, then they're like, and then I wrote a book about it. But I had actually not done that. I had, because I was in social media so early, I was one of the first 10,000 Twitter users. We were in the early podcasting movement, which was really deeply connected with social. So there were no other people talking about social at the time. It started a movement called PodCamp, which started in Boston in like 2005 or 6 or something. And so when someone said, oh, people should write books about social media, keep in mind this, like, again, 15 years ago, at the very beginning of this stuff, I had written some ebooks about it with my co-author, I think, at the time. And they were just like, here's a book deal. And I was like, okay, like we had decent Twitter audiences and Facebook audiences. And then it blasted us into a stratosphere of New York Times bestseller really quick. And I was like, holy hell, like it's really hard to hit a list. I don't know if you know, but like we're talking to a number of different author or friends of mine, like a lot of them who I'm on a first name basis with. It's really hard to hit a list. And we had done it really quickly, bam, just like that. But I had never really operated a business. And so my switch to, I'm kind of like this weird expert on internet and technology and marketing, but having never really operated a business myself, was a very, very much an example of imposter syndrome and being able to manage it and overcome it. Like, what am I doing, you stupid idiot? Like, I was very convinced that I could be like the way Godin, Seth Godin is a very famous marketing writer. You might,
Also,
people here
he's also a
might.
previous host or previous
Yeah,
guest on
there.
the
Yeah,
podcast.
there you go. Yeah. So Godin, his thing, and the thing that a lot of the people in this space at the time were thinking were like, oh, you could just kind of like write a book, or like my another friend of mine, Jay Baer, or there's a few of them that are all in this space. And they just like write the book and then they sell the speech. And I had a speaking career and all these other things. And I was like, is this like the best that I can do? And in my mind, I just felt, there's something really interesting here. And I really feel like I can make an impact. I actually didn't know. I'd never raised money before. I remember talking to my buddy, Greg Eisenberg, who I've known a very long time. And now I have like a pretty big podcast, I think, and Twitter profile. And I've talked to him and being like, I haven't raised money. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. Like, why am I even doing this? It's crazy. And he's like, look, here's how you do it. And he had done it a little bit himself. So he knew more about it than I did. And I was like, okay. And I went out there and I discovered I mean, it's not super easy to be a tech CEO for sure, or a founder, right? But at the same time, I was like, man, this is my space. And I really like this. It was also super stressful. And I just went out and did it. And all of a sudden, my first shot at ever starting a company was this name brand company that millions of people used, and even today people still recognize
Massive, yeah.
and say that they really like. And it was the first thing that I had ever made in tech, right? Because keep in mind, before that I was in like media and I was in front of the camera and not really an operator of anything. So it was like a big, really, like I would say a pretty crazy trial by fire now that I think about it. And looking back again, I don't know why I succeed. I kind of know a little bit why I succeeded, but I don't know why, like what prompted me to believe in myself, if you could say it that way. Like, it's not really clear to me how I believed that I could do this.
Okay, so is you had already written a book on essentially how to market yourself to oblivion, to like better than anyone else, and now you're building a business and building it to, that hallowed ground of a really big, special, massive business. How did you not feel like you knew a little bit of what you're doing?
Oh, man, dude, because in my mind, I had divided the world into two P types of people. The first type of person were people that did things, and the second type of person were the people who talk about it.
Oh, really? And you just thought, oh, I guess I'm one of those people that talks about it.
In my mind, yeah. It's like my father used to say, those who can do, those who can't teach.
Right.
Right.
And those that can't teach, teach Jim. Mm.
Right. So I don't know that I believe that anymore, right? Like, it for sure. And actually, especially as a CEO, so much of your job is communication, actually. So mm-hmm. I don't know that that dichotomy, but I really believe that. It's really interesting to sometimes think about the things that you believe that are actually false. I'm sure there are some, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's probably a number of them. One of them that I believed was there's a distinction between being able to do something and being able to talk about something. And I was really good at talking. And I still think I'm really good at talking, like top 10% or something like that, maybe more. So in my mind, the idea that I could also build a business just, and literally, like, one of my coaching clients recently told me that I built Breather on hard mode, which is, I think, is true, because every tech is hard. Every tech company is hard. But real estate, operations, fundraising, a lot of fundraising, you know,
from Montreal,
engineering, product, everything
in Canada,
in Canada. In Canada, right. And so there was no evidence, like zero evidence. And again, like, my father was not like an operator of a business the way that we're talking about here. No one in my life was an entrepreneur. Very few people that in my life were entrepreneurs. And I had not learned how to be an entrepreneur in a strict sense. But I didn't think of myself as an entrepreneur, even though I had a blog. The blog had a kind of business model. And so, so it was not, it was a dichotomy that I felt I wasn't clear that I would be able to overcome. But at the same time, I had just written a book, not the social media book, Trust Agents, but another book, Flinch, that was like, hey, if you believe it, go out and do it. Was kind of like a version of how to think about that book. And I was like, well, I just called out a bunch of people, I guess, including myself. And so I guess I got to do it. And it was almost as if something that I had written before was like telling me that I needed to go and persevere despite the lack of evidence. And I'm fortunate that I was able to build such a amazing brand and such an amazing venture for the first time. Lots of people take tons of shots on goal and never get one. And so I don't have complete understanding, I have some understanding as to why I was able to do that. But, you know, I was lucky that I took that leap and that it landed the way that it did.
Walk us through an emotional low in that, either in that traversal or while you're maybe years into building it, that... that has shaped who you've become as an operator and an entrepreneur. And then I'd also love to know just three stories in general in your life that have helped shape who you've become. But I would love to start with just an emotional low that helped shape you as an entrepreneur.
Yeah, I'll give you one that was also, that was probably one of the most meaningful things that ever happened to me. So. Because I don't come from a background, like I feel like a lot of entrepreneurs come from, as I look at my like dudes, my men and women of friends of mine that run companies and that are in any way successful at them, there tends to be like Columbia MBA or like Stanford Computer Science or Y Combinator or some other
nerds.
Thing like that.
You know? Nerds is what I say. No, I'm just kidding.
And so... in my mind, I really had never, I didn't see myself as one of those people. And to be in that world, I felt like, oh my God, like, how am I going to do this? And so often it's someone gave me a chance, And so that is, so there's a lot of people, I'm actually going to name a few of them on this podcast. Chris Brogan, my co-author, was one of them. CeCe Chapman was one of them. And so is John Stokes, a dude who runs a Canadian venture fund, Real Ventures. And so I had lost a co-founder. It was like a high-profile co-founder of my first venture-backed company, a breather. Mm-hmm. It was my first venture-backed real financing because I went straight to raising $1.5 million. I didn't raise like from angels or anything like that. And I just lost a co-founder, and it was like this crazy thing. And I was like, my round is going to collapse. And I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do here? And I called John and I told him, and he had a shot to back out of the round, and he didn't. And so I would say often, I really try to be that person today that will give people a shot. It's actually like, it's one of my weaknesses in some ways, is I will sometimes be like, this person has no experience or something, but I believe in them. And one of the reasons that I find myself doing, that's not the only reason, is because people really gave me lots of shots when I was fucking nobody. They really gave me, like, I don't deserve, relative to others, to have had all of the successes that I have versus someone who has worked harder for longer, who has been more committed. I've worked very hard, but it's often someone who has given me a shot. And so that's one of them. Mm. When he called me and he says, we're doing it, and he says, we're lowering the valuation. Mm-hmm. But not by a lot. I was like, oh my God, I finally get a shot, because I believed this co-founder was leaving, and I thought, I worked too fucking hard to have this go to zero like right now. I was like, I can't, like, I have got, like, I don't deserve to win. I remember I told Helen, I said, I don't deserve to win, but God damn it, I deserve a chance. Mm. And I was given that chance. As a result of some people who thought that it was worth making a bet on me. Another super important thing that happened to me is when I was in a podcast network in 2005, 2006, and someone who I knew only from the internet, we were all podcasters, we were like part of a network, we like promoted each other's shows. I was thinking recently a lot about this, and often Matt Galligan, who's another entrepreneur maybe that you should have on the show or that you might know personally.
No, just through mutual friends. I think I've been on an email thread, mm-hmm, or Clubhouse, yeah, room with him, but I don't know him personally.
So Matt and I have known each other since the podcasting days, because we were both very early podcasters. And he knows this guy, Derek Oyen. And Derek Oyen, one time I was like, this other podcast network, they were going to put me on Sirius, is what happened. And they were like, but don't tell anybody, it's like a secret launch. And so I wasn't able to reveal to this first group of people, I felt at the time, that I was going to be picked up by this other group. And the day that it happened, the day that it got announced, Derek sent me an email. He doesn't remember it. And I was so ashamed to talk to him the day that it happened to me. And for like 5 years after that, then through Matt, we reconnected, and he actually doesn't remember sending me this email, which is remarkable, because to me it was a life-changing event. I received an email from him that even to this day I still have on my computer, and it was like, dude, in business, your word is bond. Your word means something. You didn't follow it the way you say you would. You owed us A, you owed us B, you owed us C. You did not deliver on those things. And I had never in my life been told by an elder, because I was 24, 25, that that I was disappointing them, and that they deserve better, and that I owed them more. And it had such a, thinking back on it now, it had such a transformative impact. Like now I'm like, I'm on time all the time for every meeting I'm in. If I'm 4 minutes late, well, fuck it. People are going to know I'm 4 minutes late to this meeting. Mm. Like, and I'm so, my word is so important to me these days. Sometimes I offend people because I'm too direct, but I find myself it's very difficult for me to bend the truth. it could be considered a flaw at this point. But if I think back to it, it was right around that time that that part of me changed. I didn't used to be that way. And this email had such a huge impact on me. And I think that's the reason, why I changed my view on how to treat others and how strictly to treat the truth and to make sure to treat partners well and other things like that. And then my third thing that I will choose is actually the first time that I was ever on the internet. I would even say on BBSs before the internet even happened, when you had a modem and you dialed into other computers locally and you had to use the phone line. Mm-hmm. And it's because it's the first time that my world became bigger than just the people around me or that I went to school with. And I went to school with, you know, I did go into a privileged program for smart kids, that's true, but in a regular ass public school. And my life was just the people around me, like in my world. And so, again, no entrepreneurs, nobody with like a cool profession even, I felt, nothing like that. And all of a sudden, by being exposed to really the internet and exposed to tech, I was connected to people older than me that had different thoughts. I'd say probably at the time I mostly knew white people, and that was no longer the case after that. Like, I knew much more diverse set of people also. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, all of a sudden the world was much bigger all of a sudden, practically from one day to the next. And that has had such a big impact on me. It's now almost universal. Like, you can look on Twitter and you could be like, there's the dude there, and I want to be like that guy, or he's done the smart thing, and I want to do this smart thing, or I'm interested in this type of thing, and I want to learn this skill, and this other person learn this skill. But the world wasn't always like that, and definitely wasn't like that for me. Hmm. For me, I was completely like mentally trapped by what I was going to do with my life, by the fact that there were people around me and they were just a certain type of person. Like, I was unable to get out of that little, I wouldn't say prison, but that mental trap of mine. Mm. And by accessing is really through computers from over a couple of years, and all of a sudden my life completely changed. Like, I went from a customer service agent to a New York Times bestselling author in like 2-3 years. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden I was getting like $10,000 more for speaking gigs, and I was just some random dude. Like, mm-hmm. the it's so 180 that it's almost like difficult to conceive of. And so it just kind of, one, it was a huge impact on my life, and I'll never take that for granted. The other one is, like, how many people out there are like this? Mm. That just have not had that background, that haven't had the opportunities and the access that I was able to get as a result of timing, and that could make a big impact on the world, and we just haven't heard of them because they have no way in.
Right. Well, it's not just plugging in, but you also seizing. It has to be observed that you also seize these moments probably 10 times more than the average person when it was podcasting, or when it seems to have been connected to a potential co-author or the opportunity to build a company. So it, as Eric Reese, one of the early guests on the podcast, likes to say, there's 200% responsibility to go around. And that's when things go south and when things go north, and when they go right, there's still a lot of responsibility that one can take for seizing that opportunity, and still 100% left over to go to good fortune or chance or someone giving you a shot. That second one you mentioned of that email, what did you feel like that, you know, the hour after getting that email or the day or two after? What did that feel like?
I felt a huge amount of shame. It was weird, because at the time I felt a weird conflict. I was like, I could have told them. Matt was there, so Matt, if you ever meet him, or because I know when we talked about it, and I just remember being like somebody expects more from me, and my internal standards were much more just about me and what I thought of myself and other things like that. But I was like, I suddenly realized that I owed other people, and I think that that was like a pretty big. Because I've talked for years, all my friends know that I used to like be like super lazy, and like that I used to I wasn't super like committal to like if they needed help, I would like somehow evade having to help them out, or like we joke around about it. They're like, "What happened to you?" And I think that that's it was that email. I haven't thought about this before today, but I think that it was that email. It sent such a shock wave into my heart about who I was. I can't think of anything else that it could be that it actually turned away my the way that I behave around other with in relationships.
I've mentioned this once on the podcast before, but only once, but it in a similar area code, some of the most impactful words anyone has ever shared with me was one of my older brothers. I was maybe 24 and was traveling home for a wedding. Rented a tuxedo for the wedding and put it all just hung over on a Sunday after the wedding, kind of just threw it all into the tuxedo bag, you know, those plastic bags that the rental tuxedos come in. And the shoes and the cummerbund and the jacket and everything just kind of threw it all in there. And he had offered to take it to the rental store for me because I was running late to the airport. So just a series of irresponsible steps. But 24, I was like, whatever. It was a great weekend and great wedding. And now I'm going back to San Francisco. And he left me a voicemail that I got when I landed back in San Francisco. And the voicemail, so similar. It said, Jimmy, I just took your tuxedo back to the rental place. And the way that you threw everything in there like that, you're better than that. And if you're not, you should be.
Wow.
And yeah, wow. I mean, I don't, it's in some level, it was this seemingly trivial incident. And another level, I almost, you'll get tears thinking about it, in that how you do anything is how you do everything. And in those moments, it's not trivial. The carelessness, or it sounds like in a similar area code as your experience, this self-centeredness of like, I've got to get to the airport. I've got a place to be. I don't care the repercussions of my lack of foresight or forethought. That amount of self-centeredness, yeah, it can be a great gift for someone to shine a light so brightly that it kills something inside of you, disinfects something inside of you, to where it's no longer there. It's
Yeah, that's how it feels.
yeah, that is so. Anyone out there that has thought about speaking up and potentially causing ruffling some feathers to shine a light of truth on a friend, coworker, a partner that isn't operating at those unselfish standards. Sounds like for you and I, we're the benefactors of people speaking up.
That's a great, the one that you just told me is amazing. Very seldom does someone ever talk to you like this. I don't even think my parents ever talked to me like this. But the way this dude talked to me, and the fact that he doesn't remember it, but it set such a high bar, and it was like, "You're not there, my dude. You need to get there. You gonna get there or not?"
That is, yeah, it is kind of like there's a standard, and if you don't see it, you're worse off than you probably have ever imagined, because this standard is, you will drown by not hitting that standard. And for my brother mentioning that to me, or you, or your podcasting partner mentioning that to you, it's like, it's almost like you don't even realize there's imminent death looming around you in this realm. If you don't realize of the, you know, this standard. Okay. I want to end, thank you for sharing all three of those. With our last bit of time, I want to end this with, you mentioned two selves internally. You also mentioned superego, collective consciousness. So you're dropping some Jungian knowledge on us. When you're writing each day and you mentioned that there's these two selves to witness, do you mind going more into that and what you mean by that? And maybe it was just an offhand statement, but just the fact that you notice there being two selves within you, something that in a podcast titled Below the Line, I felt like I needed to ask about.
Yeah. So when you are, okay. So if you ever, if this has ever happened to you, you ever find yourself meditating for like a really, really, really long time, then what will happen is over time you get this psychological distance from your own anxiety. And I spent a lot of time meditating for a really long period of my life. And so it's almost as if you are an observer on top of your stuff. And so I would say that there's two versions of you. One of them is almost like the calm self, and the other one is the anxious self. And so the calm self is like, you're at peace. Like, you got what you want. And sometimes it emerges. Now, is it going to make great work? I'm not sure. Like, I don't have the answer to that. But the anxious self is also, he is status anxious. So he's like, you need to do good to compare to others, which isn't great. And you need to do more than this guy. This guy just raised this much. You need to raise this much. He is always trying to do better, but not always for the right reason. So it's, you need like the balance of these two. And as I get older, I start to like, I figure that out. I think I was also burning a lot of cash at Breather relative to this business practice that I run now. But like, so I needed to raise a lot of money, but I was also driven by, look at this, like, yes. It was the era, keep in mind, this is the era of Uber, this is the era of WeWork. I mean, you know, you were in that world.
No, right? It too well.
Yeah. And so like there's that, but to return back to this idea of voice, like that person that is trying to make success for its own sake and so that you can have something to show to others and so you can fill the eternal void of your own self, like that is not, you're going to make great things there, maybe, but you might also be tripped up and go completely in the wrong direction for 10 years. The same reason someone, their father was a doctor, so they're going to become a doctor and they're just going to go and they won't think too much about it. Sometimes I envy those people because they just know where they're going, whereas me, it took me a really long time to know where I was going. But then they might discover 10 years down the line, fuck, I didn't want this at all. And so to have that balance between the sort of the self-awareness and the acceptance, but at the same time to have that urgency of like, hey, life is short, like go do something. To me, that's the division. And I feel that if I started, it's weird to say, I have epilepsy, so I don't have seizures almost ever. So does, by the way, like Neil Young and Lil Wayne and a bunch of other people you might not think. But it's a blessing because I don't have any seizures, but because it forces me to sleep about 8-9 hours a night. And so that means that I'm always super rested in the morning and I get to reset and I get to experience like a calm thing that I think a lot of people don't get when they're entrepreneurs. And so for me, I think I need the combination of the striving self and the sort of accepting self to be able to feel good right? Like my ambition turns off for too long and I'm like, I'm okay. And then I'm like, wait, no, but hold on. I got a lot to prove and I got a lot that I want to do while I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I need the two to kind of like yin and yang be working together or something.
Mm-hmm. Are there times where you notice where one is out of whack and do you use the other to balance
it? Yeah, when I've had too much of my amber mug, my dude, this is good. You know, when I've got mm-hmm. too much coffee, definitely, I'm like, definitely then. I would say, in all seriousness, probably in cities like New York, you're in New York and everyone is better than you and everyone's cooler than you, everyone's younger than you, like... It's kind of like an endless game of comparison. It's maybe why some people move there, but it's also like incredibly, like you never get a sense of your authentic self maybe because there's everything around you that is just easy to compare yourself to and feel like shit about relative to who you are. And so that's on one side. And then when I'm out in the wilderness or right by the ocean is the other, which is like, that's the calm self when I'm away from others. Like, and so I need to kind of feed those two versions of myself.
Hmm. Well, Jung himself had epilepsy as well. So you're in good company with some deep thinkers. Well, Julian, thank you so much for this, the generosity of insight and time with our listeners and myself, just learning so much, especially as you covered a lot of these deeper topics that a lot of solo artists and authors seem to have a really great grasp of, because at the end of the day, you can only blame yourself for what you do or don't get done or what you achieve or not achieve as an author. And so it's you're one of the only guests that has been an author in this solo artist type of way, as well as this collective builder building massively significant businesses. So thank you so much for the generosity on both sides of that.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
And for those that want to learn more about you and more about practice, could you one, let everyone know where they can find more about you? And then two, I would love 2-3 minutes for you just to say how this has all flowed into building practice and what practice
so
is
to
for
me,
listeners.
Yeah, I mean, so I've always built things for individuals. So that's really what the thing is that I'm very motivated by. So to build things for service providers like coaches and to have something where we can build software that supports people that are on their own is something that's deeply motivating to us. And that's what our team does all day, as we build software to support people that are on their own doing their own thing with no other time and with no other support structure. And so we're super motivated by doing that. It's nice. Andreessen Horowitz invested a bunch of money recently. And so from that perspective, it's a practice.do. And then for me, I'm all over the place. Twitter maybe is most common. I'm just at Julian, written the French way, J-U-L-I-E-M on Twitter. And it's just all over the place. You'd find all kinds of things that I've done in the past. I've been on the internet for a long time, publishing and shooting my mouth off. So it won't be too difficult.
Well, thank you again, Julian, and looking forward to seeing all of the greatness that is ahead for what you're building with practice and helping coaches around the world. It's a phenomenal. Please go check it out. Even if you're not a coach, go check it out because it's just extremely thoughtful software that is being built, and I've watched it from the sidelines. One of the things that I've been most impressed by you as a founder is how thoughtful you've been with doing things the right way. Specifically, you just pushed off trying to grow or some external validation, and I love that. You focus, I hope you don't mind me sharing, just focus on what 8 customers were saying, what 10 customers, what 12, what 20 customers were saying for months and months, going deep with these initial customers instead of, hey, let's build a graph going up into the right and validate what we're building with with quantity, but you've been doing that with quality for that's the nerves of steel of a second time founder to say this thing will live or die by the quality in which we build and the quality in which we have our relationships with our first customers. I mean, I think it might have been 10 months with just 8, 10, 12, maybe 20 customers.
Yeah, eventually it does need to go up into the right, and gratefully it has. But it's true, and even Andrew Chen, who is our investor at Andreessen, is like, careful not to grow too fast. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure people really like what they're doing. It's very easy, especially if you have a lot of money to build something. It just goes up, but there's no underpinnings and there's no deep, real sad thing that people are being satisfied by on the long term. You know it. You've talked to people that it has happened to. I know it. I've talked to people for whom it's happened to. And especially in this world, very easy to inflate things, much harder to derive a long-term value.
Mm-hmm. Well, kudos to you. Well, thank you, Julian.
Thanks for having me.